Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
We're having fun. Before we press record, we're having fun in the studio, and we were laughing, and I'm trying to not laugh right now. But anyway, it's good to laugh, but it's not good to laugh when you are the host of a podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 33, season 4 of the Undermine podcast by Osiris Media. I am your podcasty host, Tom Marshall, and we're in the thick of Phish's fall tour 1997, the tour some people consider their best ever. And I don't know yet if I'm in that camp, but there have been some pretty compelling arguments for it on these podcast episodes. And I forget if my co-host and Osiris Kingpin, RJB, is one of those people who makes the fall 97 peak tour claim. What say you, sir?
Hello, Thomas. Hello. Yeah, I mean, I think that it is the peak of the era, which I guess is sort of qualifying and maybe not fair.
That's unfair.
I think it's probably the peak of everything, but it's certainly the peak of the era of 1.0 Phish.
Okay. All right. Good enough.
Actually, it is the peak of Phish.
There it is.
But there might be another one like next week.
Next peak. All right. So what are we doing today?
I don't think so. Nothing. I think this is practice. It's a test run. So we're in the middle of fall 97. We're stopping in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, one of my favorite towns. I spent a lot of time there, more in Salem than Winston, but it's 11/23/97. It's a Sunday night. It was a crazy show. We have a return guest to help us go through this show. And as we always say, if you enjoy what we're doing and you want to support Osiris, check out osirispod.com/premium to check out our new premium offering. You can get bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, and a lot more. And we know all of you have memories and you're sharing them with us from these fall 97 shows. send us a video clip on social media, 60 seconds, post it on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, tag Osiris Pod, tell us about one of these shows or many of these shows, and we're going to choose someone who's going to win a special prize from Tom Marshall. Okay, Tom, who is our guest?
Okay, I am rummaging around in my attic for the special prize that you guys are going to win, but that's for later. Today, we have a guest named Brian Brinkman. You may recognize his name because he's an executive producer of Undermine, but he's also a longtime Osiris podcaster in his own right. And also because he was just here, a guest on our show earlier this month, talking about the Amsterdam show in February of 97. Brian is our secret weapon, an expert fish analyst we deploy only in emergencies. And I feel if this isn't an actual emergency, we could turn it into one. Please look who's in the freezer as I open the vault. Brian Brinkman.
Tom, hi, Brian. RJ, how are you guys?
We are doing fantastic.
Wonderfully.
Fantastically. Ah, there you go. You used an adverb and I upped my game.
Correct form. Very well.
Yes. Very good. You got an adverb when you're supposed to. Brian, welcome back, my friend. Fish, now here in the middle of fall tour, back in America since we saw you last. And they just played two nights, Friday and Saturday, at Hampton Coliseum and blew the roof off the place by every account. Here they are the next day, November 23rd, 1997. It's a Sunday in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Never miss a Sunday show. And they don't seem tired at all from Hampton, where there's no way anyone got any sleep. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they showcase how energized and how locked in they continued to be by releasing this as the third part of that box set. I think most people in the years leading up to the 2011 release would have thought we're just going to at some point get 11/21 and 11/22/97. But I think that they knew both that this is all one weekend, but that there's a lot of themes that are carried over and expanded upon. And in some cases, I think really interestingly, fought against from the successes of Hampton, as this band is kind of at this point now 10 months since we last talked about 2/17/97. Obviously, you guys have talked about other 97 shows, but that band that was having so much fun and had discovered this new style and this new sound has been growing within that and perfecting that over the course of spring, summer, and now here we are in the fall, and they're kind of able to do anything and anything really, really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah, Brian, this is like, I mean, we can talk about set one, but the evolution of the sound is, you know, the tour started 10 days before this, but just in the first set, you hear Black Eyed Katie. The whole sound is totally different than the first version. There's four versions of the song in 10 days. But this is like a totally different take on it. There's really no funky aspect to it at all. It's just like a really intense rock peak, which I feel like we hear throughout this. But I don't know, as the tour goes on, as we're looking really closely at it, you see these kind of like waves over the course of the tour, you know?
Yeah, and can I say something slightly controversial early on in the podcast? So I love Fall 1997. It is one of, if not my favorite Fish tour of all time. I think it is one of, if not the greatest Fish tours of all time. We can get into the nuances in a different podcast where we break down tour by tour, but it's incredible. Every time I listen to it, you immediately know you're in Fall 1997. You hear this band that is equal parts arrogant and curious and creative and surrendering to the flow. To me, Fall 97 is always thought of as this funk tour. To me, the best parts of Fall 97 almost have nothing to do with funk. And this show kind of exemplifies that. And you talk about it immediately in that Black Eyed Katie. That's a funk riff that they kind of wrote during soundcheck, brought to the stage, would later turn into MoMA Dance. But this version doesn't sound like the version the night before in Hampton, which was very funky, very gooey. A lot of early MoMA dances are very dance heavy. This is a rock approach to it. And this is like the band taking this connected way that they've been playing vis-a-vis funk and applying their rock and roll, their love for like arena rock to it. It's so interesting to listen to.
That was it wasn't a controversial enough take to turn this to the level of emergency, as I alluded to earlier in the show. But it is controversial, right? Because everyone's talking about funk, and here we have a rock show, I guess you'd say. The night before in Hampton, and RJ alluded to this, they also played Black Eyed Katie. And you know, they played it a lot, I guess. Playing two songs in a row isn't too common in Phish. And later in Phish, when they now have like so many songs to choose from, I think it's pretty rare. What other songs did they commonly play in consecutive shows?
So I went back and looked at this. We were talking prior to recording. I went through some like the big Phish songs to look at the last time there was a repeated version. And the majority of them, as you would assume, happened before 1997. For example, AC/DC Bags' last repeat performance was 2/7 to 2/8, 1991. Slave to the Traffic Lights was 2/20 to 2/24, 1988. After 1997, this became an incredibly rare experience. There's, I think, five or six songs that have been repeated from one show to the next, just to give you kind of what those look like. You Enjoy Myself, and this is taking out like one was played on the last day of the tour and then was played the first day of the next tour, or was played at the end of a tour and then was played on the holiday run, so on and so forth. These are just one show. You Enjoy Myself, July 26th to July 28th, 98. Antelope and Chalk Dust Torture were both played on July 14th, 2013, and then on July 16th, 2013. Golgi was played on November 29th to December 2nd, 09. Bathtub Gin, June 12th to June 14th, 2011. Tweezer, June 24th to June 28th, 2012. And then Down With Disease, October 22nd and October 23rd, 2010. Those are the last versions post-1997 of repeats one night to the other.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for delving so deeply into it, Brian. The one that I guessed, I think, wasn't even on your list, and that was Character Zero. Because I remember during this tour, you know, that came out of the gates like a racehorse, that song. But then they played it and played it and played it and played it, kind of like Caspian. And it kind of got on a few people's not favorite song, you know, list for that reason. And I thought you were going to say that Character Zero was played repetitively back to back, but I guess it never made that list.
Well, actually, the last repeat version was November 23rd to November 26, 97. Still in 1997. But yeah, it's right at this point that we're talking about that they would repeat that song, because the next version is like a 20-minute version. It opens the second set. It's mind-blowing. But to your point, it's interesting. Like, you can almost think of this year and this tour in some senses like 1994, where they were pushing very specific songs. You know, 1994 got ragged on at the time because it's so hoist heavy and all these hoist songs that the band's really trying to push because they're consciously trying to push this album for the first time. You get that here in 1997 because they cast a bunch of songs off in February, wrote all these new songs, and then these new songs fit this style perfectly, and they're trying to figure out how do these new songs pick up and carry the weight that old, you know, heavy jam vehicles and heavy hitters, your mics, you Enjoy Myself, your Stashes. How do we have new songs kind of carry the weight for our creativity going forward? And so as a result, you get a lot of repeats, which we even see that stuff happen today. You know, there was like the Fuego tour of 2014, where you saw Phish, you were going to see a Fuego at one stop. And by the end of the tour, it almost became a joke. And there was the Oprah Winfrey, you get a car, you get a car, gif that was going around.
You get a Fuego. Brian, Brian, we can stop talking about Black Eyed Katie soon, but I want to ask you, because yesterday people heard the Night 2 Hampton show, and then this was like, as you guys have been saying, two in a row. But this song, you know, it kind of like disappeared, obviously, or melded into Moby Dance at the end of the year. But these sort of, I don't know, six versions on this Fall 97 tour, I know you like to look for these or see these patterns in Phish. I feel like they sort of mirror the tour. Like, this is sort of like a dark and stormy period of the tour where it's just like kind of rock and roll. And then by a couple shows later, it kind of goes back to being a kind of a funk vehicle. What do you think, like, what role did this song play in the tour?
I feel like this song, like, I remember first reading about this song before I ever heard about it in, like, the Farmer's Almanac or the Fish Companion or something like that. And the way it was described was the entire sound Fish was going after was coalesced into a single song. And I think, to your point, like, I said this earlier, that to me, the most interesting aspect of this tour has nothing to do with the funk. It's the ambient jamming in Stash in Las Vegas, or the Simple and Dogface Boy Mike song segment in 12297. It's this bathtub gin that's so aggressive. And you hear a song like Black Eyed Katie kind of mold and evolve with the tour and with their inspirations. You know, I think you said it really well. Where they're at in the tour, you hear it through a song like this. You also hear it through Ghost. You know, you think about that Denver version that's so expansive and has all these different ideas, but ultimately turns into a rock peak. But then you go forward 5 days from here to Worcester, and it's suddenly a funk song again. And it's you know, and you go 3 weeks later and it's going into Johnny B. Goode. And like, it's a song that kind of showcases, along with Black Eyed Katie, how the band is feeling night to night. They're all, regardless of the style they're playing in, they're fully connected. And so they can use these songs as a way to kind of mirror how are they feeling more. Is it slightly more aggressive tonight? Are they leaning into Hendrix more? Are they leaning into James Brown more? And it's kind of that like pass back and forth between those influences, along with the way that the band is peaking at the time.
I love the analysis, Brian. It's always spot on. And it's like, kind of like, you know more than the rest of us. And yet you just watch and listen just like us. And you know, it's incredible. Some of the inferences you can draw that are, to me, spot on. This Stash, you mentioned it, and you can't talk about set one of this show without mentioning it a little bit more. It's almost too much. It's like, it's wonderful and then chaotic. And at times it's noise. It's like Trey just sort of like guitar practice, like noodling weird fusion riffs on top of this like stormy ocean. But then like halfway into the song, they get into that weird pulsing rhythm, which I love. That's my favorite part of the song. It's like 10 minutes in, and then it blossoms into some incredible stuff. And then they skip the regular maybe so, maybe not ending, and just go right into NICU. I don't know if I have a question really, apart from, I guess, is this the jam of the show?
I think it's the jam I enjoy the most. I think, you know, we obviously have to touch on Bathtub Gin and, you know, just how aggressive and long that is. But I think you're right. Like, I was thinking about it. This show feels like the distant cousin of Summer 1995 Fish, where they're really trying to experiment with music during this show. And they didn't necessarily do this in the previous two nights in Hampton. So I kind of wonder if it's just changing locations, or if it's just like something in the water, something in the air. But they sound like they're channeling this band that went on stage every night with a goal of challenging their audience and testing their audience and being like, can you follow us? Like, are you willing to follow us as deep as we're going to go musically? And it's going to get weird. It's going to get noisy. You're not going to like all of it, but like, trust us. It also reminds me of, like, there's a quote from Page in the It documentary, where he's talking about the 38 minute, 46 days that they play there. And he talks about, there's a segment of music that gets so beautiful and so peaceful and so calm, like 20 minutes into that. And he talks about how without challenging themselves and diving completely off the deep end, you never find that music. Mm. And that music doesn't exist unless you work through all these battles. I think to your point about the stash, like it showcases this band from 2 years earlier that still exists. That's like, this may fail completely and we may after 17 minutes not find something and just abandon it. But instead they find this like 3 minute segment of music that kind of foreshadows the music that they would play towards the end of the decade. Like that millennial hyper groove hypnotic sound that you would get going into Big Cypress. It's like you hear that band being bridged with Summer 95. I don't know if you guys heard that in the stash, but I kept thinking about that while listening back to it.
Yeah. You said my keywords, hyper groove hypnotic.
That's Tom's username on a lot of message boards.
It is.
I think the other aspect of it is just the, like, they weren't analyzing stuff.
Yeah.
Right. In this tour, we talked about that a couple episodes ago, but that allows them or forces them, depending on how you look at it, to like have those conversations within the music, you know, and like kind of just push everyone's pushing in different directions sometimes. And then it ends up in this really, really unique place. So it's really awesome set one.
It's my job as a host to say it's time for a break and we will be back with set two. After a quick word from our sponsors, if RJ lets me get through this sentence.
Don't do it. Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K.com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's distrokid, capital K.com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week, I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.
And we are back. Our guest today is Brian Brinkman, and we are plunging into set two of November 23rd, 1997, which was in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Go, RJ.
So, Brian, let's talk about set two. Again, we're kind of diverging from the funk in this show, I think. The gin opener has similar vibes to the Black Eyed Katy in that it's just hard driving, it's rocking, and man, it's a pretty cool jam, but it does not represent, I think, what most people think about when they think about this tour.
No, I feel like the closest corollaries to this jam are the Wolfman's Brothers from Champaign on 1119, as well as the one from Worcester on 1130, which I think pissed a lot of fans off because it's basically like 12 minutes of one riff that just gets louder and quieter and louder and quieter. I love it. This gin is not really like easy to listen to. Like I listened to the Haleys from 1122 and this back to back. And it like shocked me how different the band sounds. Like that Haleys, to make a sports analogy, that Haleys is like a modern basketball team where you have like shooters out past the 3-point line. So you have all this space and guys can drive and cut and pass and you get an open shooter and it's beautiful. And like the entire jam is as if it was composed. Every single section just makes sense and everyone has just enough time to breathe and kind of exhale and then move on to the next thing. And it's 24 perfect, perfect minutes. And this gin is like a Jackson Pollock painting. It's just like, they're just like throwing ideas and just seeing what happens. I mean, I don't know if it's good music or if it's just like the band like blowing off some steam. I don't really care. I really like it. It's just, it's so aggressive for so long. And to me, this is them leaning into, you know, we can play as loud as Led Zeppelin right now in an arena. Trey can play as fast and aggressively as Jimi Hendrix, but it's as evil and demented as King Crimson. Like it's all these styles of music that the band has listened to and is in their DNA, all just being poured out over a 30-minute jam that I don't think could have been planned in any sort of way. It's just like, just go and we won't stop until we stop.
Yeah, 30 minutes goes by quickly in this, I think. I mean, you know, sometimes it's like hard to hang out there for 30 minutes, but this one goes by pretty quickly. It's pretty wild. And then they, you know, into Down With Disease, which is 10 or 12 minutes. And then the Lowrider is pretty fun. I'm not like, I've said this on other shows, like I'm not really one for the thematic cover going in and out of songs, but this is actually, I feel like the Lowrider is really fun. There's like, it's pretty long and it gets into a groove. It's not just like a tease that they find themselves in.
I'm on the same page with you, but I do like it here. Kind of like you. It fits there. If there was ever a point where Phish was going to sound like, you know, they could play a song like Lowrider and like they existed in the mid 1970s, it's 1997.
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny to land in something like that after this kind of disjointed bathtub gin that I do think they were like, they were all just in that bathtub gin, like just kind of messing with their effects. And there was like a lot of different layers, but it didn't really like smooth out as much as some of the other jams. But now they get into this Lowrider. It's just so simple. And it's like a little bit of a break, but it still keeps things moving. This, out of those three shows that came out of this, you know, sort of box set, this is the show I listen to the least, but I wonder how you think it ranks compared to the other two. Like if you take these three as a kind of Friday, Saturday, Sunday show, like where would you put this one?
I think I would put it at the third. I honestly, I don't think this is one of the great Fall 97 shows overall. I just think you're dealing with a lot of really, really great shows in the tour. For me, the 1121 set two is one of my favorite sets of the entire tour. I think it flows perfectly. And the Haley's, obviously, the Mike song from 1122. It might be my favorite Mike song ever outside of 1995. You know, I was really puzzled when they released this along with the Hampton shows, but I think it does a nice job thematically of both rounding out those two shows while also showcasing how much diversity is. I mean, you think about three set two openers being that Ghost, that Haley's, and then this Gin. It's kind of the three sides of Fall 1997 in a lot of cases. I also think, and I don't know how deep we want to go on this, but like you do see this band at this point in time moving from Mike's, Yem, Tweezer, Stash, Bowie as like the jam vehicles that guided them from 1992 to 1995 to now Gin, Ghost, Wolfman's, Down with Disease, even a song like Twist that's on like the periphery of this show, but is going to play a huge role. The Island Tour is going to have an amazing Japan 2000 performance. You know, you just are starting to see the band move away from what was the bedrock of exploration. And like, this is what's going to be your show highlight when you walk away. We start playing Mike's song. That is going to be the song you're going to walk away with. To now, newer songs are being introduced as the songs will kind of carry the weight, which is, as we think about this tour 25 years later, you know, you can go through 2.0 where Piper becomes a huge jam vehicle, and then 3.0 where songs like Light, later Everything's Right, become huge jam vehicles, and Set Your Soul Free. And, you know, we see the band starting around this point to abandon those earlier songs as the, you know, the hallmark of a show, and start to say, what are the next songs that are going to carry us, and how are these next songs going to help us evolve?
Yep. And just to put the sort of period at the end of a sentence that I opened up a long time ago, when we were studying early 90s, it seemed like every early 90s show depended on a Mike's or a Tweezer, and then like maybe Ghost or Wolfman's possibly started dominating set lists around this tour. And then this show doesn't have Tweezer, Mike's, or Ghost. And I think you just kind of answered that question. So yeah, it's just good to point out that Phish was able to begin turning any song into the, you know, the atlas that's carrying the weight of the world.
Absolutely. And you're going to see that throughout this tour as it continues. I mean, this tour is only 10 days old at this point in time and has 3 weeks left to it. And you're going to start to see additional songs start to carry the weight. And when we move into the Island Tour, you know, there's obviously a great Mike song, there's a great Yem, there's a great Tweezer, but there's a lot of other songs that are a part of that celebrated four-night run and beyond. And that's, you're just seeing this band kind of change and evolve in real time here while also being at a peak period. And that's such a rare thing to like be that successful. And night to night, you're playing great shows and great jams, but you're also evolving on kind of a macro scale in ways that will impact you 20, 25 years later. You know, I don't know. It's just mind blowing to think about.
So, okay, Tom, well, first of all, I just want to say I've only seen Bold as Love three times and I just really want them to keep playing it. It's one of my favorite covers. Paige is so good on it. It's just like, I don't know. I just think they should play it more.
Agree.
No arguments. No argument. Okay.
Tom, there's a really great Julius encore. There's a bunch in this tour. There's actually several, including a couple other shows that I was at. And they just really, like, it was just a chance for Trey to just kind of, like, shred at the end. And it made me think there, you know, this song is, and also Fishman yells the whole time while Trey's, soloing, which is just eggs him on, and they just keep, like, it's a really good version. But Are the lyrics of this song a direct historical reenactment of the assassination of Julius Caesar in 44 BC? Because I think it probably went down exactly as this song is performed.
Simple answer, yes. A direct historical reenactment. You know who called me out on this? It was a brand new album, just came out, and John Popper, this is actually up in Bearsville. Fish must have been working on, or maybe working on mixing. Anyway, he had listened to Hoist. I forget what Fish was working on at the time. Or anyway, he drove up in a Jeep and he was playing Hoist and he was playing Julius. And he called me out. He said, they gave it to me, but I really don't want it. I came out on top by the luck of the draw. He said, that's nothing like Caesar. He said, Caesar wanted it. And I was like, you know, I just kind of wrote it. Like, you know, you're right. Maybe I should pay more attention to actual history if I'm using a historical person. So
I just feel like you were channeling the like first 2 years of the Clinton presidency and the rising contract with America and the looming 94 midterms. I interpret it as you taking 44 BC and putting it in 1994 America.
Thank you. I'm going to go with that from now on. And John Popper, I hope you're listening. That's the answer.
That's the answer.
Brian, I think I know that the answer to this. However, I'm going to give you another chance to tell us whether these three shows, the two Hamptons and this Winston-Salem, are they the peak of the Fall 97 tour?
I'm going to say it's a peak. And the reason I say that is I think that if you take 11:17 through 11:23, you have this one segment that crosses the country is these 5 days. But then I think if you go with from Philly to Dayton, you get another peak. And then if you fast forward, you get the New Year's run. That's another peak, which is not the tour, but is like this late 1997. I think that it's one of the things that when you start to like look at the nuts and bolts and the stats of this overall tour, one of the things that this tour has that most tours don't have. Most tours have like a great stretch and then some periphery that's really interesting that like all leads up to this is why X is a great tour. This tour does something that's very rare where it peaks in a distinct style. And this is not to take anything away from Hartford and Worcester. I think those are excellent, excellent shows. But it almost feels like they're kind of relying on old tricks. And then from what I hear in Philadelphia, especially that second set, they uncover and they unlock something new, which takes them through the next weekend in both Auburn Hills, Michigan, as well as Dayton. And there's just music that's played there that is foreshadowing where this band is going and is also showcasing just how high of a high they're on.
Yeah.
So sorry to complicate your simple question.
Oh, yeah, it was a yes-no answer.
I think that's a good point, though. It's also like different, like these are four or five song second sets in a row, you know? Yeah. Whereas like later in the tour, you get more songs, you get like a little more going on in the second set. But I like the way you're looking at it.
Always great details. Always great details.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Yes.
Oh, here we go.
All right. Just very simple. You guys are going through every single show. And at this point, I'm guessing you're probably, as we're recording, a few weeks ahead of like the actual date that we're on. Are you guys hearing Fall 97 in a new way at all? And if so, how so?
I am, because now I'm hearing it all. And I only saw maybe three or four shows. So, and as you guys know, I think both of you know, my memory isn't, I don't go back and listen to shows much. So this has been an incredible eye-opening experience. I'm willing to sit back and kind of let you guys guide me into the really good shows and really good sets. And I got to say, favorite right now, just because it's very recent, are the two Hamptons. And I actually had that disc set, what was it called? It was just called
Hampton, Fall 97. Winston-Salem 97.
Yeah. And that was in my car for a while. So anyway, I hope I answered your question.
Yeah. I always listen to the shows that I was at, which are like, you know, four or five of them at the in December, like usually on the date. And listening to the whole tour, I think the thing that I'm hearing the most is just the variety of styles. Like I love the Hampton shows, but it's like I've listened to these shows so many times, so it shouldn't be surprising. Yeah. But listening to them all in a row, you hear this evolution of like we talked about earlier, like deep funk to like explosive rock to also like really contemplative, beautiful space that I think is always kind of secondary to what we think about when we think about the tour. So it's really fun to go through every show and hearing it in different ways. I can't wait to listen to some of these other ones because I think we're gonna keep hearing new things, you know.
Agreed. Thank you, Brian, so much. Thank you, RJ. And that's it for us today. Thanks to all you listeners and thanks to the Osiris team, especially Eric Limarenko and Matt Dwyer, who are making all of this work from behind the scenes. And a quick shout out to Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Check them out at cashortrade.org. Please remember to review and subscribe wherever you listen or watch. Goodbye, and please remember to blaze on.
Osiris.
Hey, music fans. We wanted to let you know about Music on the Mountain, a show that will feature Anders Osborne, Dogs in a Pile, and Saints and Liars. This show will be directly after the Divided Sky Foundation's fun run at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 18th, at the base of Akemo Mountain in Ludlow, Vermont. The show is presented by The Phoenix, a national nonprofit organization offering support to those in recovery and anyone impacted by substance use to celebrate recovery. If you're running in the Divided Sky Foundation's fun run, you'll be automatically registered for the show. It's a family-friendly event, and all proceeds from ticket sales and other donations benefit the Divided Sky Foundation. Visit Music on the Mountain, that's musiconthemtn.com, for more info and to get tickets. That's musiconthemtn.com. Hope you enjoy.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen, and wherever you get your podcasts.